This is Masters in Business with Barry Ritholtz on Bloomberg Radio.
This week on Masters in Business on Bloomberg Radio, we have a special guest. If you are a fan of quantitative finance, modeling, any application of mathematics to the world of investing, this is really a masterclass in what the world used to be like in finance when people really, you know, math was optional as opposed to how things have developed today. Professor Emmanuel Derman is the head of financial engineering coursework in the master's program at Columbia University. His background is really quite amazing, and I go into a lot of detail in the program. Suffice it to say, at Goldman Sachs, where he eventually became head of the renowned quantitative strategies group, gives you an insight of what sort of mathematical and programming background he has, helped Goldman Sachs make ungodly gobs of money by the intelligent application of modeling and risk management. A lot of people don't think about the blocking and tackling and the basic approach that you have to engage in when you're dealing with things like stocks, bonds, and options of illiquid assets that are hard to come up with a price because they don't necessarily trade all the time. Anyway, really a fascinating conversation. If you're at all interested in quantitative finance and modeling, and you're not a student at Columbia, you don't often get access to someone like Professor Derman, and I think you'll find this to be a really interesting conversation. So without any further ado, my interview with Professor Emmanuel Derman.
This is Masters in Business with Barry Ritholtz on Bloomberg Radio.
My special guest this week is Emmanuel Derman. He is a particle physicist and better known in the world of finance as a quant. His background is quite fascinating. Born in South Africa, came to the United States later in life, spent 17 years on Wall Street, eventually becoming head of the renowned quantitative strategies group at Goldman Sachs, where he co-developed the Black-Derman toy interest rate model and the Derman-Connie local volatility model, both of which have become industry standards. He won the IAFE SunGard Financial Engineer of the Year Award in 2000. He's the director of the master's programming in financial engineering at Columbia and author of two books. The first, My Life as a Quant, Reflections on Physics and Finance, and more recently, Models Behaving Badly. Emmanuel Derman, welcome to Bloomberg.
Thanks. I'm very glad to be here.
So you're someone whose career I have followed for a long time, and I would imagine a lot of our listeners are probably not familiar with either yourself personally or what you do. So let's start with a really basic question. What is financial engineering?
Okay, financial engineering, it's sort of a polyglot field. It's not really one simple thing. It developed over the last 25 or 30 years. It's a mix of building models for describing businesses and more particularly securities involving mathematics, statistics, the use of computer science, programming, all inspired somewhat by physics or scientific type models and using the kind of math that's traditionally used in describing the inanimate world or the material world, but now applied for better or for worse to the world of stocks, bonds, securities, options, etc.
So that naturally leads to the next question. How does someone transition from being a specialist in particle physics to a specialist in quantitative finance?
Yeah, it's like, how do you get to Carnegie Hall? Practice, practice, practice.
So there are obviously some similarities.
A lot of models, a lot of heavy math. Yeah, so a lot of the modeling, particularly in options and in describing fixed income instruments, actually has its origin in economists who were trained in physics and started applying that kind of math to physics. So stochastic calculus, series discounting, all really are physics or mathematics, in particular physics inspired models. And so it's kind of a fairly natural transition for people to make. The trouble is a lot of physicists don't have the economics or the finance background. And 30 years ago, that wasn't a problem when I did it. They didn't expect you to know anything. The whole quantitative finance field was sort of amateur heaven. You just came along and people told you to pick up. It happened to me when I came to Goldman. They said, read the Cox-Ross-Rubenstein model for pricing options and start working. And now, so it was fairly easy in those that they hired you if you had potential. Now it's a much tougher transition. It's become a professional field. I'm in charge of a program at Columbia where people get degrees in the field, professional degrees, and you can't just from an economic point of view, there's a glut of people. It's not so easy to get in now.
So when we look at physics, you're dealing with inanimate objects that aren't pushing back. They're not getting excited about rumors. They're not getting panicky. But in finance, you have the individual players who are all suffer from cognitive foibles and emotional extremes. How do you adapt to that shift from particles, which are pretty clean and interesting, to humans, which are messy and volatile?
Yeah, that's you put your finger on the key problem in the whole field, which is
people.
Yeah, people, exactly. and that's why the models don't really work as well. When you make a model, or even Newtonian mechanics for describing how planets go around the sun, the planets don't really care what you say about them. And if you publish an article about them, they don't change their position, even if you have the wrong theory about them. But really, if you look at what happens in financial markets, they interact with people. Financial markets are all about opinions, and opinions affect the future and affect the present. So it's a much iffier field, and models don't work as well. They don't describe the system as accurately, but they're not useless.
Mm-hmm. That's the famous George Box quote.
Yes.
All models are wrong, but some are useful. Obviously, if you have a useful model in finance, it can make a lot of money for its owners. How does somebody like George Soros and his theory of reflexivity, how market prices subsequently affect market prices, how does that impact someone who's trying to create a financial model?
Well, I think it impacts it. I think most financial models don't really take account of reflexivity. There's some models maybe are starting to do that, but I wouldn't say they're trading models.
Mm-hmm.
If I can summarize in one sentence, I would say that anytime you build a model, it's a financial model, it's mathematical, you have to keep in the back of your head that you're actually short volatility, meaning if the world changes, your model's going to be wrong. It may make money for you, it may lose money for you, but it's certainly going to be wrong. Most models only work in a very narrow regime where things are more or less like the world you're in currently.
Mm-hmm.
And you see when you get to negative interest rates, for example, or when volatility blows up, or when you get, you know, the great financial crisis, all of these models stop working.
Since you hinted at this, in terms of a changing regime, I'm thinking about the models that were put together by a firm like Long Term Capital Management in the late 1990s. In the last minute we have, is that why they blew up so spectacularly? The world changed and their model failed to adapt, plus 100-to-1 leverage?
Yeah, I think my impression of what happened to Long Term Capital was that they were basically looking for very small deviations. Most things that earn you money in markets are when you buy something illiquid, because illiquid things tend to be cheap. And so they were buying off-the-run treasuries, out-of-the-money options. I don't know the details anymore, but essentially things that were cheap but in the long run would revert to the mean and give you the full amount. But they leveraged up like crazy to accentuate small pennies differences. And then when Russia defaulted, what happened was everybody in the world got scared. There's a flight to quality. Nobody wants to hold illiquid stuff. And they were so over-leveraged that they were put out of business.
I'm Barry Ritholtz. You're listening to Masters in Business on Bloomberg Radio. My special guest today is Emmanuel Derman. He is a professor of financial engineering at Columbia University. He used to work at Goldman Sachs, where he was head of the Quantitative Strategies Group. And I want to talk a little bit about a book you wrote a few years ago after the financial crisis called Models Behaving Badly. And one of the first things that stood out to me from that book was a sentence you had written: models are metaphors that explain the world we don't understand in terms that we do understand. Expand on that.
Okay. Yeah, that's my feeling. I can give an example. So what I tried to do in that book was distinguish between models and theories as different means of approaching trying to explain the world, animate or inanimate. And models seem to me to be analogies in the sense, for example, you say the brain is like a computer, or the computer is like a brain, people used to say. Now mm-hmm. they go the other way. Right. Or they say the heart is like a water pump. Or there's a great quote I like about fixed income from Schopenhauer, where he says, sleep is the interest that we have to pay on the capital, which is called in a death. And the more regularly the interest is paid, the further the date of redemption is postponed.
Huh. So in other words, it's important to get 8 hours a night's sleep.
Yes, and if you can get 8 hours a night's sleep. But if you think about what he's doing, he's sort of, there's a small overlap between sleep and between paying interest on a bond, which is that you sleep regularly and you pay interest on a bond regularly. Right. That's really the only analogy. And then, but on a bond, you've borrowed money and you have to pay it back at the end. And now he's saying you've borrowed your life from the darkness, and at the end you have to pay it back again, and you're right. paying back darkness all the way. So I think that's a good example. And most of the models in finance are analogies where you say, for example, in the Capper model or in modern finance, you say stock prices behave like smoke diffusing from a cigarette end, you know, doing Brownian motion. That's not literally true. It could be true, but it isn't.
So in other words, stock prices don't randomly fill a room, evenly distributed like the behavior of a gas.
Right.
But you're creating a metaphor that, hey, it's somewhat random. It's a little predictable, but not very predictable, especially over the long term.
Exactly. And for example, in physics, that's called Brownian motion, this mm-hmm. motion of diffusion. In physics, that really is a theory. It's an accurate description of the way smoke behaves. Mm-hmm. But stock prices don't behave that way. Volatility jumps, stock prices crash, Apple rises or jumps by 20 or 30 bucks in a day, more actually, sometimes 10% in a day. So it's not a diffusion. It's something that's violent.
So why are we so enamored of all these metaphors?
Because we can't do better. And the difference is, I think economists don't understand. I like to not be too rude about economists, but they don't understand the difference between a model and a theory, or a metaphor and an accurate description. Mm-hmm. And physicists, which is my original background, actually understand that very well. So for example, if you say Newton's laws, which describe the planets going around the sun, they say force equals mass times acceleration. That's really accurate. Mm-hmm. May not be perfect, but it's very accurate. On the other hand, they might say a nucleus at the center of an atom is like a liquid drop. And they understand that when they say a nucleus is like a liquid drop, it isn't really a liquid drop. Mm-hmm. It's just a lot like it, but at some point that analogy is going to break down. And people get Nobel Prizes for saying a nucleus is like a liquid drop, and they get Nobel Prizes for doing what Feynman did, which is an accurate description of electrons. Mm-hmm. But physicists understand that one of them is truth or close to truth, and the other one's just a model.
So let me go off script and say, how accurate is it to say that economists suffer from physics envy?
Yeah, I don't know who originally coined that. I think maybe Andy Lowe, who's a professor at MIT. Mm-hmm. I think that's accurate. I think maybe it's fading to some extent. Now, the behavioral finance people clearly don't. Mm-hmm. But yeah, they do. And, you know, Bachelier, the guy who started a lot of the stuff, and Paul Samuelson, they were all had a physics math background somewhere in there.
And I notice that you drop a lot of philosophical references in discussion. Is that from the financial engineering side, or is that from the physics side?
I got a late life interest in philosophy. Mm-hmm.
Well, it's throughout your books. I notice you're always referring to that. We'll come back to that a little later. Let me give you a quote of yours that I found intriguing and wildly overlooked by a lot of investors. If you want to take a chance on the upside, you have also to take a chance on the downside. Explain what you mean by that.
What I mean by that, there was a response to, I think you wrote a book about this too, to the bailouts mm-hmm. of 2007,
8, 9. Right.
When I felt that there were a lot of companies around, banks in particular, but financial companies that were taking risk and saying, that's the essence of capitalism, and sort of leave me alone and let me do what I'm good at. And then suddenly when everything collapsed, they wanted to be saved from death. And I found that incredibly, I don't know whether ethically or morally, sort of disturbing.
Hypocritical.
Sure. Yeah, and saying, oh, the whole system will die if you don't save us. And that's what I meant. If you want to be somebody that benefits from taking risk, you also have to benefit when taking risk kills you.
So in other words, you can't have privatized gains and socialized losses.
Yes. And I like to think that what a lot of the banks should have done if they were saved by the saved by the government was they were essentially given a put, if you look at it from an options point of view. They were saved from death. And if they were given a put, they should have given away a call to the...
When they survived.
Yeah, when they survived.
Some companies had a little... AIG gave the government some... I mean, it was forced upon them. And then the GSEs, Fannie and Freddie, they essentially became
wards of the state.
Yeah,
yeah, I think that's fair. You can't get $10 million bonuses the year after you were saved from death.
Doesn't make sense. So should we have nationalized those companies, cleaned them up, and then spun them out as freestanding companies with the benefits of those IPOs going to the taxpayer? Is that a better ethical way to do this?
I think it's a better ethical way to do it. I have friends who I argue with this about, and they say the whole system would have collapsed if we hadn't bailed them out. People I know at the Fed who say everything was, you know, credit was on the verge of sort of freezing up. But I think it's left a permanent bad taste in everybody's mouth.
Oh, certainly created moral hazard that, hey, you know, look, it's arguable to say we rescued Bear Stearns and the Fed backed up J.P. Morgan's purchase, and that might have given the impetus to Lehman Brothers to say someone will come along and rescue us, right? Is that a fair assessment of that?
Yeah, there was a funny cartoon. This was a little maybe not right, but there was a funny cartoon by Barry Blitz, I forget his name. Mm-hmm. It's a New Yorker cartoonist who had a picture somewhere in 2008 of Obama dressed as a New York City policeman with a hat and a navy mm-hmm. uniform and walking down the street twirling a baton with his eyes cast up at heaven as though he couldn't see what was around him. And meanwhile, people behind him were running with bags of money into buildings. And that sort of typified it for me.
It was certainly an interesting period. I'm Barry Ritholtz. You're listening to Masters in Business on Bloomberg Radio. My special guest today is Emmanuel Derman. He spent 17 years at Goldman Sachs, eventually becoming head of the renowned Quantitative Strategies Group. He also is currently the director of financial engineering at Columbia University. It's a master's program, I believe. Is that correct?
It's a master's program. It's a sort of 12-month to 18-month professional degree.
He also is the author of Models Behaving Badly and My Life as a Quant, Reflections on Physics and Finance. Let's talk a little bit about quants on Wall Street. You mentioned when you began 25 years ago or so, it was a wide open field. There was no playbook. But here it is. We have high-frequency trading. We have algo-driven strategies. We have all manners of mathematical investing, mathematically-based investing. Is this the age of the quant?
Yeah, I think it is, actually. I mean, when I started out, very few traders were very numerate. They didn't know a lot of math. They hadn't studied. A lot of them came from law backgrounds or stuff like that. And now, in fact, quant was a derogatory word. I've got a dictionary from the late 90s where somebody, it's by Mark Kritzman, called A Dictionary of Financial Terms, and he says quant, and he says quantitative analysts often use pejoratively. And when I wrote that book called My Life as a Quant, what was actually in the back of my head was I took my kids 25 years ago to see a Swedish movie called My Life as a Dog.
Sure. I remember
that.
You
see, that was a great movie.
Absolutely.
For kids and parents to see simultaneously. And I was thinking of my life as a dog. That was really in the back of my mind. When I came to Goldman, quant was a sort of like being a geek or being
Right.
And people laughed at you, although they kind of treated you with respect. I liked it, but it was a kind of mocking kind of respect.
So since you brought that up, let me go back to a question I missed. So you were at Goldman Sachs in the 1990s. That had to be one of the questions I was going to ask you was, how were the quants treated? So you said there was some degree of respect, but were you treated as one of their own, or were you guys kind of on the outskirts and people, you know, slipped pizza under the door and kind of left you alone?
That's funny. It varied. For a while, I worked for Fisher Black in his group, and mm-hmm. then he had everybody sit on the desk and get lunch when the traders got lunch, and you were kind of more equal. But generally, I would say that didn't last long, and people people treated you like geeks, but like useful people geeks. That they spoke to you.
What's the expression? Useful idiots? Is that yes. how they looked at? Did yeah. they? Was that the actual vibe there?
Yeah, or? when I got there in 85, which was earlier, people would get in the elevator and sort of make jokes and say, "Oh, all of you are allowed to travel in the same elevator at the same time." Uh-huh. You know? Or I wrote about it in My Life as a Quant. I would be with some guy and I was very excited about being on Wall Street and it was interesting. I would say something to him about duration or convexity and he would get embarrassed and shrink away and say, "What do you think of the Yankees last night?" You know.
So in other words, he didn't know what convexity or duration actually.
No, he knew what it was. He just didn't want to be outed in the elevator.
Oh, in other words, he was a geek.
He was
to
a geek like
a
me,
profile.
But he didn't like me talking about it in public. But
that's
then,
funny.
But then, even in the early 90s, you know, I remember when. Not just Quants, but everybody, if you had a PhD, you didn't put it on your business card. And if you had an email address, you didn't put it on your business card
really?
Because that was like the brand of Cain, you know?
Uh-huh. And that's amazing. Yeah, you'd think that that's early something 90s, to be proud about.
Yeah, early 90s, people didn't want to put email addresses or PhD degrees on their business card. Now, of course, they'd love to do it.
That's, wow.
So Quants become, yeah. Quants.
Things have changed. So you were at Goldman when they went public, right? 99?
Yeah, 99.
What was that like from the experience of someone with your background on Wall Street?
You know, I think things were steadily improving for Quants, although at the same time, Goldman was getting much more bureaucratic. But by that time, you'd been through long-term capital.
Right.
You'd been through D. Shaw, so LTCM, so all sorts of hedge funds starting to make a lot of money out of supposedly quantitative strategies and particularly the whole internet, not bubble, but the whole internet excitement, mm-hmm. where suddenly being technologically competent became a way to make money. And mm-hmm. so that kind of, or even destroying the whole system like LTCM gave you respect. So
right.
things were getting better for Quants.
But by the late 90s, I have to think Renaissance Technologies had been putting up absurd returns for a long time, right? I mean, if memory serves, didn't Jim Simons return outside investors' money sometime around then?
A little bit later, but yeah, only have their own money now.
Which tells you, hey, these guys are really putting up huge returns without a whole lot of capacity to do it in the tens of billions.
Yeah, D. Shaw as well.
Returns outside money.
No, didn't return outside money,
but
were very visible.
Right. And at that point, don't people look around and say, hey, these guys are minting money. Let's get us some quants and maybe we need to pay these people proper respect.
Well, they gave them respect and they paid them kind of decently. But there was still, at least in the area I worked in at that point, there was still a very finite gap between being a trader and being a quant. Now I think that's vanished a lot.
Mm-hmm.
But then you were a support person. You weren't a position taker.
I'm Barry Ritholtz. You're listening to Masters in Business on Bloomberg Radio. My special guest today is Emmanuel Derman. He is a renowned quantitative thinker, teaches financial engineering at Columbia. Used to run the quant group at Goldman Sachs. I think that's a pretty good CV to chat with little old me. Let's talk a little bit about models and what they can and can't do, because every answer you've given me has set off in my mind a number of digressions, but I wanted to stick with some of the questions. So you look at models and you look at what they can do. What is it that people can do that models can't?
Well, I think the right way to use models is to sort of quantify your intuition. Like, people can have intuition, but it's hard to translate that intuition into a number.
Mm-hmm.
And so, for example, if somebody said to you, what should I pay for an option? I know the price of an option at the money. What should I pay for an out-of-the-money option? You know it should be less, but it's hard to actually quantify how much less. And if you have but when you look at Black-Scholes or options pricing, they invent the whole notion of volatility and measuring volatility. And just like you can have intuition about interest rates, a human being can have intuition about, will volatility go up? How much will it go up by? How much will it go down by? And what the model does is let you take something you can think about in your head, like interest rates abstractly, and convert it into a dollar price.
So now let me ask the opposite of that question. Let's say you've developed a model and it's working well. At what point should a human intervene and say, hey, this model is no longer producing the output we expect? We need to make modifications. How does one even begin to think about that?
When I worked at Goldman, we kind of tried to write the last 2 years I was there, I was in a group called Firm-Wide Risk, not in quantitative strategies, where we were trying to look at derivatives risk throughout the firm. And we sort of had a recommendation that every time somebody write a model, they be forced to specify all the assumptions and conditions they were making so that they could specify when these things wouldn't hold. So, for example, if you build a model to price options on Apple, you're pretending interest rates will be pretty much stable. You're not worried about interest rates. But if you suddenly go to some emerging market country where interest rates can rocket to 100%, somebody should understand that that's not the right model to use.
That's interesting. On a related note, how could you tell the difference between a model working its way through a rough patch and a model that just no longer works?
That's a really tough question that's especially applicable to people who do statistical arbitrage or people you mentioned like Renaissance. Or I think that's very difficult. You have to – two ways. The first way is statistical. You sort of have to have some idea of when you're getting results that are statistically unlikely. So if your model is correct, maybe you'll get, you know, some fraction of the time something that's one or two standard deviations away. But if that persists, you start to say I'm in a different regime or the model is broken down.
Right.
And then the second way, which I also like, is you really ought to have some – a model isn't just mathematics. A model has some idea beneath it structural about the way things behave, how people respond, how markets behave. And you ought to be able to make some sort of judgment as to whether the world is still behaving according to the assumptions that you make.
So it has to be disprovable if X and Y and Z happen – therefore, the underlying thesis of the model no longer applies.
Yes,
that's quite interesting.
I like the idea that I was going to say this earlier. I sort of think just using mathematics blindly is kind of stupid, and most models get their inspiration out of some economic or financial idea first, and the mathematics is just the implementation. Where you get into trouble is when you think that the mathematics is the thing in itself rather than the idea that's behind it.
That goes back to the George Box quote. They're wrong, but some are useful.
Yes.
Let's talk a little bit about some changes that quants have forced on both markets and investing. There was recently a column in the Financial Times that talked about the secret sauce of hedge funds and how quants are essentially reducing what some people have previously called as alpha and identifying it as a factor that can be reduced to mathematics, and others have suggested that the quants are part of the reason why hedge fund performance has been so mediocre over the past decade or so. As the quants have risen in prominence and stature and influence, the ability of a person working in a hedge fund to create outperformance, to develop alpha, is going away because of what quants are doing. What are your thoughts on that?
I've sort of got a rush of thoughts coming to my head
when
you say that. Because I think all of the things you said are partially true. I think the first one, it's true that the whole hedge fund and asset allocation or asset management world has become much more quantitative. When I started out, nobody in those areas knew a lot of math or used a lot of math. Now they all do. As a result, I think they're all in competition with each other. And I think if somebody has a good idea some way, people move around a lot, and these I've literally seen examples of somebody from one firm going somewhere else, bringing an idea there. They use it. They get irritated because somebody else leaves and takes it somewhere else. So I think these models propagate a lot and become widely used. And that does cut into the so-called alpha of everybody.
We saw a little bit of that with LTCM when people had left or the people covering them at different brokerage firms ended up moving around, learning a little bit about what they were doing. And so a lot of people were piggybacking those trades, as bad as the leverage was, when every desk on the street's imitating it. It's really a crowded trade.
Yes, and now I think people actually have sort of statistical mathematical models that they fit to the whole surface of stock prices and decide which ones are cheap and which ones are rich. And somebody takes that model somewhere else or maybe finds the inspiration for that model in some finance paper that's buried somewhere. And people actually mine finance papers for these sort of anomalies or behavioral anomalies and start to implement them everywhere. So I think these methods of finding alpha are getting a shorter and shorter lifetime.
So in other words, it's either arbitraged away or just imitated and it loses its ability.
That's my impression, yeah. But at the same time, So there is a lot more of this quantitative stuff. But at the same time, to be a little on the cynical side, all of the hedge funds and asset managers are in a competition for assets under management. Mm-hmm. And they all like to pretend that they have more secret sauce than maybe they actually do.
Right. So what does that tell us about the future of asset management? We've watched lots of money flow to Vanguard, which is primarily a huge indexing shop. But we've also seen a lot of money flow to hedge funds despite a pretty bad run of underperformance.
Yeah,
what explains that? Is it just marketing wizardry, or is there something more than that?
No, I think there are people in hedge funds that really do have some skill that people who are just doing indexing, which doesn't take any skill at all, really.
Mm-hmm.
I think they do have a skill. I've seen studies that show that, especially in very illiquid complex instruments like mortgages, as opposed to equity long short, which is fairly simple, that hedge funds that tend to do better than average one year, there's some persistence. They tend to do better than average the next year.
So it's not just a random distribution.
I don't think it's just random. I think if you have skill, it tends to persist. But on the other hand, the whole world is becoming so swept by people trading mechanically. For example, I think if you're a value investor now, then you kind of buy things when they go down.
Mm-hmm.
And you think they're cheap. On the other hand, they're momentum investors who think momentum is a factor, and they sell things that are going down and buy things that are going up. So I think the large number of people that are now acting in this mechanical way with some model, like following momentum, tends to mess up the people who are looking for value, and it's much harder for hedge funds to compete in this world.
There's a quant named Wes Gray who writes Alpha Architect. And they have a model that is both momentum and value. It's actually two sleeves.
Huh.
And he said one sleeve is always doing great while the other one is doing terrible and vice versa. But over the long haul, both of them actually work out pretty well. That just gives you an idea of the complexity of what we've seen come along, that just there was nothing like that 10 or 20 years ago.
Yeah, you look at the risk parity people that say you should have, instead of being 60% equities, 40% bonds, along the same philosophy, you're better off having one third of your risk in commodities, one third of your risk in equities, and one third of your risk in bonds, which means leveraging up bonds a lot because they have such low volatility.
Right.
And they also believe that in the long run, that will work best. But in fact, they've done badly for the last few months. So,
well, you know, we saw a lot of money flow to risk parity
as
bonds looked like, as rates looked like they were bottoming, and as a lot of the commodity complex seemed to be topping out about 5 years ago.
Yes.
So if you're a third commodities and gold is down 30% and oil is cut in half, that's going to have a pretty big impact on your returns.
Yeah, I like to be a little philosophical and say that if you take a model too seriously, it's a kind of idolatry in the sense you're assuming that you're assuming that you can write down a formula that's going to mimic the way people behave, but people are too complicated. And if you really believe that you can capture people in a formula or equation, you're looking for trouble in the long run.
I know you have a website, emmanuelderman.com. If people want to find more of your writings, it's My Life as a Quant and Models Behaving Badly. And you post regular papers at emmanuelderman.com?
Not that often anymore. I do go on Twitter regularly. I'm a fan.
Mm-hmm. What is your Twitter handle?
At Emmanuel Derman, in one word.
At Emmanuel Derman. If you've enjoyed this conversation, be sure and check out our podcast extras, where the tape keeps rolling and we continue the conversation about physics and quantitative trading and philosophy. Be sure and check out my daily column on BloombergView.com. Follow me on Twitter at Ritholtz. I'm Barry Ritholtz. You're listening to Masters in Business on Bloomberg Radio. Welcome back to the podcast. Thank you so much, Professor Derman, for doing this. This is really fascinating stuff, and I don't think people get to hear you often enough other than a handful of Columbia students. And I've been following your career long enough that I really wanted to get you in here and put you under the microscope. So let's go over a couple of questions that we missed earlier on. And I know I only have you for a finite amount of time, but we got plenty of time to go. So first, let's go back to 1996. This was way ahead of the curve. In 1996, you wrote an article titled Model Risk, pointing out the dangers that inevitably accompany the use of models. How did that play out?
I think it played out pretty accurately, actually, although I was sort of looking, I can't remember too clearly, but I was looking at two kinds of risk. One was implementation risk, where you have the idea right, but you've got all sorts of computer problems or right. inefficiency problems. Then I was looking at what happens when you actually have the idea wrong. And yeah, there was the first paper I think ever written on model risk, and I think it played out kind of accurately. That's what sort of happened.
So the next question, let's see if I can fix this little thing here. That is, there you go. So the crisis in 2007, 2008, how much of that was a function of models not working well?
You know, as part of it definitely was, but I don't think it was the fundamental cause. There were a lot of things happening. Mm-hmm. My sort of slightly biased view is that really interest rates were very low and everybody was trying to stretch for yield and do anything that would get more yield.
Absolutely.
And that's partly the Federal Reserve's fault, but whatever. And I think models played a secondary role in that they were used to construct, perhaps somewhat deceptively through the rating agencies, instruments that purported to give you a high yield with a low risk. And so models were a tool in trying to cater to high risk, but cater to disaster, but I don't think they were the fundamental cause.
It certainly, when you look at the rating agencies, I'll never forget being in a conference room when a bunch of salespeople came in and were pitching us this new fangled subprime product. And the phrase that resonated with me was, this is just as safe as U.S. Treasuries, but it pays 250 basis points more.
Yeah.
And to me, it was, well, which is it? It can't pay that much more. If it pays a little more, it'd get arbitraged away. But how could it pay almost 3% more? That either you guys are going to win the Nobel Prize or you're going to be wearing orange jumpsuits, picking up trash on the side of the road. It turned out neither were true. Most of the people who participated in that, well, they just moved on to the next thing and there was no subsequent accountability. But the rating agencies and the idea that, hey, we've taken dross and turned it into gold, people widely believed that that was possible, wasn't it?
Yeah, you know, I always like to make the analogy that finance is a lot like nutrition in that people take a small amount of information and extrapolate it like crazy, you know, so they will tell you women should or shouldn't get estrogen or you should or shouldn't eat eggs. And then they change their mind dramatically a few years later. And it's hard to tell who's a crank and who's correct because basically they're all aimed at, I don't know, they're all aimed at marketing in some sense.
I'm fond of saying predictions and forecasts are marketing because that's all they are. But it's amazing how common sense, and granted, this is all after the fact, but a lot of common sense could have saved people a lot of money. How could it be as safe as Treasury and yet pay so much more? But nobody really stopped to ask those questions then. It's amazing. That 96 paper is really a decade ahead of its time, and it turned out really to be significant, which leads to my next question. So models behaving badly, how did that impact capitalism and the great financial crisis?
Yeah, I mentioned this earlier, but I found the whole thing really disappointing. I'm sort of disillusioned in that it's what I said earlier. I somehow expected that I sort of like capitalism, but as I said before, I think if you want to benefit from taking risk, you've got to suffer the consequences. And that really hasn't happened. And
I'm with you on that also.
Yeah, I know you wrote about this.
Well, from my perspective, it's like everyone's a capitalist.
You wrote Bailout Nation.
Nation. Yeah. Everybody's a capitalist until you know they're in trouble, and then suddenly they become temporary socialists until they get there.
Right, right. I don't know.
It was astonishing to see how quickly people flipped from that. Let me go through some more of my questions. We went over I have something that I've been dying to ask you. I love this quote of yours. The efficient market model, a model and an analogy, but not a valid theory. How is that not a valid theory? Let's hold aside for whether or not the efficient market hypothesis is accurate, but why isn't it a theory?
It's not a theory because it doesn't describe the way things really behave. If I can give you an example of I had a sort of anecdote to tell you of what I meant by a theory in a corny sort of way. When my son was very small, I used to put him on my knee and play with him and bounce him up and down. And my sister used to do it to me, say, half a pound of tuppany rice, half a pound of treacle, mix them up and make them nice. Pop goes the weasel. It's an old English thing. And then you drop your knees and the kid drops down to the floor and he chortles with glee. And then he said again, and I did it again. And then he said again, and I did it again. And when I did it the 15th time, when I dropped him down, he said to me, why it's not funny anymore. And so there's no explanation of why it's not funny anymore. The fact is, if you tell a joke 15 times, it's not funny anymore.
Right.
And that's both a fact and a theory. It's true, and there's no explanation for it. That's just, so I was trying to say earlier about Goethe, when you describe something that's true, you can't say why is it true, you just say it's true. And the words are the theory, and the fact is that that's the way it behaves. The efficient market model is not like that. Markets are inefficient.
Mm-hmm.
It's a model. It's not a description of the way the world actually is. The world could be that way, but it isn't.
So I'm fond of saying that markets are kind of, sort of, eventually somewhat efficient.
Yes, in the long run, more
right.
or less. I used to like to say that the efficient market hypothesis or model was a very clever jujitsu trick by economists who couldn't predict what was going to happen, and instead of giving up, decided to make that a principle. So turning sort of weakness into strength.
That's interesting, and it is true. Everybody who believes in the efficient market hypothesis also believe that in the random walk, we don't know what's going to happen. So therefore, buy low cost indexes and rebalance on a regular basis.
And that's good as long as not everybody does that. You still need somebody out there looking for value. Otherwise, yeah.
As much as money has been flowing to places like BlackRock, iShares, and Vanguard, it's still a tiny percentage of the overall investment. What is it, $3 trillion in indices now?
$3 trillion in ETFs. I read that today. Yeah,
not a whole lot of money relative to what's the total investable universe, $68 or $75 trillion?
Worldwide?
Yeah,
I think so.
Yeah, that's
US
right.
U.S. is maybe $20 trillion. I'm not sure.
I think the U.S. equity markets are about that. The bond markets are more, and then you have the rest of the world. At one point in time, U.S. was almost half of the investable assets in the globe. That has since changed. So
you know, I think a lot of models work well related to what you were saying. They work well as long as you're just a ripple on the sea.
Mm-hmm.
But when you become the whole sea, then
the model stops.
Then the model stops working.
Right. It's you no longer are trading in the market. You are the market,
yeah.
And that's a very different. I love this line. Explain for us, what is the unbearable futility of modeling?
Oh, is that a line of mine?
Yes.
Okay. Well, I'm not sure where that comes from, but it's.
I believe it's a chapter or subchapter heading in
Models Behaving,
models behaving badly.
Okay, maybe it's a subchapter
towards the end.
I'm not sure what I meant by that, to be honest. I think I probably just meant what I said before, that in the end, you will always be wrong, and you will never. You know, if you, it's what you were saying earlier. If you find some law of nature, it kind of holds forever, and if you find a model, it's inevitably going to require revamping, changing, alteration as people start to change their behavior.
Do you miss physics at all, given the certitude that you get in physics versus always dealing with uncertainty about what's happening and about how long a model is going to have validity?
No, I don't. I'm very glad I got a background in physics, but I'm also at this point glad I got out of it. It's like a rough life being in physics because there's so many incredibly smart people that you actually run into people and you say to yourself, I can sort of understand what they're doing, but I could never have done that myself. So it's actually a bit of a relief
really?
To be out of there. Yeah.
So you come to finance where essentially it's easy to be the smart guy.
Well, I'm reasonably smart, but finance also, actually physics and finance, there's lots of room for taste, I think. And where people go wrong is when they don't have taste and they start slavishly sort of following the mathematics too much. Physics is really driven by ideas and then mathematics to implement them. And I think should be that way in finance too.
I'm going to push back on you a little bit because I think you were a grad student and you wrote a paper on, it wasn't Higgs boson, but maybe it was one of the Higgs particles.
Yeah, I did.
That became widely, widely regarded. And to do that in physics as a grad student is no easy thing.
No, I wrote my thesis on writing tests for how to find a W boson that was caused.
Don't ask me where I pulled that from, other than Wikipedia. But
no, that's true. And then they eventually discovered that. Although I was, I was a reasonably good physicist, but nevertheless, and maybe in finance too, but less so in physics. You run into people. I heard Feynman talk or people like that. Or
Richard Feynman over in California was at
Caltech.
So was that intimidating or impressive?
It was kind of intimidating, or even I sort of wrote in my life as a quant in my memoir, I wrote sort of, you see your ambition slowly getting degraded when you're like 18, you want to be like Einstein. And when you're like 25, you want to be like the professor that you know in your department. And then when you're like 32, you say, gee, the guy at the desk next to me is getting more invitations to give seminars than me. And then you suddenly think, wow, look where I've got to.
So it's that competitive and it's that...
It is competitive. I got a job as a particle physicist at Boulder in 1979. It was my last job in physics. And there were like 140 people applying for one job.
Wow.
It was really rough. I mean, it was after the Vietnam War. There was no money for research anymore. All the physics jobs had filled up when there was still a lot of money before the Hatfield-McGovern Amendment, which stopped money going to research. And I was maybe number four on the list or something. And the first three either had dual career problems or got better jobs, and I got the job. But it was kind of discouraging after a while.
So what about today for financial engineers? You mentioned there's lots of quants around. Are there still opportunities for people who want to go into this field and apply mathematics to finance?
Yeah, I think there are. There's a much bigger market for risk management now. Some of it is PR. People just want to say they have risk management, but sometimes they have real risk management. And what I liked about, if I talk personally, what I liked about going to Goldman as opposed to being in physics, I liked physics, but in physics, you somehow had the feeling like you had to be really superb or otherwise you were wasting your life because you spent all your time, I was doing theoretical physics, sitting in an office and banging your head against the wall trying to solve something difficult, and you could spend half your time sort of depressed. What was nice about being at Goldman, what I actually liked about finance was it was a more multi-sided world where you spent part of your time doing theory, but part of your time writing programs and part of your time interacting with clients and with traders. And so there were many more sources of satisfaction. You had long-term projects and short-term projects. And I found that very satisfying. I got quite excited when I went to work at Goldman.
So after almost 20 years on Wall Street, you transitioned to being a professor. How do you like teaching? How do you like working with young people?
I like it. I would say it's not as exciting as being on Wall Street. People in universities are sort of siloed in that everybody's there because they want to get on with their research and have students.
Uh-huh.
And so I would say, in a sense, being at Goldman was more collegial than being in a university for me, despite the university being a college, because actually everybody wants to sort of, I'm exaggerating a little bit, but leave me alone, I have work to do.
Right.
Whereas at Goldman, you could go to somebody and say, oh, I'm thinking about this problem, can you help me? And because you're all paid to pull in the same direction, they sort of helped you more willingly, I would say.
So a little more of a team effort on Wall Street than in a university where everybody has a list of things to do and students to deal with and midterms and papers.
Exactly.
And they're tenured, so go away, I'm busy.
Right.
that's fascinating. How has quantitative investing evolved since you began in the industry all those years ago?
Well, first of all, everybody on trading desks is, as I said several times before, much more numerate now. A lot of them can write their own models. A lot of them studied math, especially in derivatives. You get a lot of French or even American students who have all gotten advanced degrees or PhDs in finance. So that's become much more complicated. The second thing that's changed a lot is electronic price feeds and electronic settlements. So suddenly computers have become much more important.
Jeff Gundlach tells a story about one of his first jobs on a bond desk. He shows up with a math background and is able to do some really basic calculations in his head, and everybody there thinks he's a wizard because they're not math guys, yet they're on a bond desk 25, 30 years ago.
Yeah, I started out on a bond desk, and actually along the lines of what you're saying, I worked on this model, which you mentioned, the Black-Diamond toy model. But I think one of the things that had almost as much impact was that I could program well in a world where people couldn't. And I built a user interface that let the traders enter a trade, save it, think about it, come back the next day and talk the salespeople, talk to a client again. And user interface makes a lot of difference. So mm-hmm. in those days, if you could actually, in those days, you couldn't get somebody to do it for you. If you could do it yourself, you could be that much more effective if you knew the theory and the programming.
Huh. That's quite interesting. So that was leads to, what was the first model you built at Goldman?
It was this Black Diamond toy model.
And that was for interest rates?
It was a model for options on treasury bonds, options on interest rates. Mm-hmm. Goldman was doing a lot of business. People were beginning to extend Black-Scholes, which is for options on stock,
sure,
to options on bonds. And it's actually quite a complicated problem to do consistently. And
I can imagine.
Yeah, because bonds are all, you can pretend Apple and Walmart have nothing to do with each other and write an option model for each. But you can't pretend a 5-year bond and a 3-year bond have nothing to do with each other, because the 5-year bond will become a 3-year bond.
Eventually.
Yeah. And so you have to really, there are many more constraints on building the model.
So what is it that people misunderstand about quants and model in finance? The layperson has an idea about a person sitting in front of a computer, but what does the average person not know about what's happening behind the scenes that is telling as to just the perspective of quants in finance?
You know, I think academics or other people who haven't worked with trading desks imagine that you're making predictions all the time.
Right.
And I think the truth is, most of the time, certainly in derivatives, you're not making predictions about the future. You're trying to figure out in the present what's cost too much and what's too rich and what's too dear. And your models are much more geared to saying, this is more expensive than it should be and this is richer than it should be.
Mm-hmm.
And then the prediction is, okay, the rich things will become cheaper and the cheap things will become richer. But most of your time is spent trying to, at least most of my time was spent trying to figure out how to tell the price of something illiquid from a lot of liquid things.
Mm-hmm.
So for example, if you went to buy an option, how would you figure out the option price from the stock and the bond price, which are both liquid?
Right.
And so the example I like to give in a way, it's also a metaphor, is if a lot of the problems you face with is not what will happen to the price of apples in the future if you're dealing with fruit, but what should I pay for fruit salad given the price of apples, pears, and peaches?
Got it.
And so you say, what's the cost of canning? What's the cost of buying the apples, pears, and peaches? And this should be the price of fruit salad. And then sometimes you do the reverse. You say, I know the price of fruit salad. I know the price of apples and oranges. So what's the right price for pears? But it's always trying to figure out in the present how to get the liquid thing, given the price of the liquid things, how to get the value of the illiquid things.
Huh,
am I making sense?
Yeah, no, that's quite fascinating. You're absolutely
so
making sense.
So less prediction than trying to figure out what the current price of something should be.
And very often there's incomplete information. If something is liquid in trading, then we know what the price is. But if something is illiquid, doesn't trade a lot, you really don't have a market-based price. So you have to come up with a different way to figure out what you should or shouldn't pay for this? Is that a fair way to restate it?
Yes, and the prediction comes less in predicting what will happen than in saying, this is cheap, and eventually I think my model says this is cheap, and so eventually it will come to what I think is fair value.
Everything comes back down to reversion to the mean?
Yes, yes. Yeah, that's fair, I think.
Okay. So what other quants do you admire? What quants have moved the industry forward?
I think Fisher Black, most of all. I wrote a lot about him in the book that I wrote in my memoir, My Life as a Quant, because mm-hmm. I think he was kind of an exceptional guy, both from a character, a difficult guy, but exceptional from a character point of view,
mm-hmm.
in that he liked to tackle everything ab initio. You know, he would...
From scratch, right from start.
Yeah, right from the start. Somebody who was totally unknown could come to him and send him an email about something, and he would think about it, you know, without any prejudice.
Uh-huh.
And he thought about everything in his own way. So I kind of admire him. I kind of admired Steve Ross and Mark Rubenstein. They were more PhD academics, but for their setting out the whole basis of option pricing, which I spent most of my life on. I kind of admire Paul Wilmot, who I once wrote a paper with. We actually wrote on the financial crisis. We wrote a financial modeler's manifesto. It was a bit of a joke.
I recall that now. For people who may not know, Wilmot puts out a quarterly quantitative
magazine
on really developments. Paul Wilmot, is it?
Paul Wilmot, yeah.
Right, developments in the world of quantitative trading and analysis. And it's really high-level stuff. When you sift through it, as I on occasion have done, most of it's going to be over the head of the average trader, the average investor, the average person. But within the industry, I have to think that that's become practically the go-to Bible. Is that, am I overstating it?
Maybe a little bit, but that's one of them. But I sort of admire him because he's written some, I mean, for that too, but he's written some good textbooks. And I like to think, like me, he tries to make things simpler rather than complexify them. There's been a tendency for finance academics to do everything in a very formal, axiomatic way as though they're teaching math. And Paul and myself both like to use the least amount of math possible.
Huh. That's quite interesting. So let's keep plowing through some of these questions here. We talked about the FT. We talked about alpha. What's been the impact of high-frequency trading and algo-driven trading strategies on the sort of work that, that you do?
Very broad. If I talk from a sociological point of view, I see from the students at Columbia until a few years ago, they all wanted to take derivatives. And the last year or two, everybody's being tempted probably by the job market and by excitement to work on high frequency trading, algorithmic trading. And now for the last year or two, machine learning, meaning, you know,
you're programming machines to just plow through all the data that's out there and figure out their own rules.
Yes, or even things like, can you scour the internet to find out whether there were a lot of cars in Walmart parking lots the last year, you know, to try to get source advice.
There have been people doing that with Twitter. Can we identify sentiment shifts on Twitter and then generate a tradable algorithm from that?
Yeah, I've noticed that. So a lot of that stuff, some sentiment based, some really objective, like can you figure out in some way how much sales are happening in various places from data you can collect on the internet? What was your question again?
I have no idea. So I have no recollection. What's the impact of high frequency trading on model development and model construction, and then actually having these models execute in the market if there are theoretically predatory algorithms looking for whatever it is they're trying to do?
Yeah, I think if I get a little bit general, there have been sort of two classes of models that people use in finance. One are structural models, where, like for derivatives, where you say an option is really a hybrid of a stock and a bond, and I've got to figure out exactly how it works, and that's what Black-Scholes does. Mm-hmm. So it's really saying like an option is like a molecule made out of atoms, and there's a structure there. And those were always what quants mostly did. But what's happened, as you point out, in the last few years is econometric or statistical models have become much more the rage. And students are going in that direction where you just say, can I find a regression between various factors that seem to predict the market? I don't care. I care a little bit why, but I care less why than finding the actual pattern. And that's become – so statistics and econometrics have become much more – fashionable as a result of high-frequency trading and algorithmic trading.
That's interesting. Why econometrics? How did that work its way into the sort of modeling?
Looking for relations between time series, between Fed behavior, between interest rates, between the behavior of factors and particular stocks. So less caring about why it's happening than detecting a pattern.
So I see a lot of these sort of correlations, and they always make me, and I see people writing about them, and I read articles, and I see charts, but the back of my head, I'm always saying, well, yes, but is one thing causing another? Is this a temporary, sometimes they're in sync, and some, I can't count how many people have been insisting, well, look, the Fed cut rates, and here's what the market did, and now we have quantitative easing, and here's what the market did, and as soon as this unwinds, the opposite's going to happen. And they run in parallel for long periods of time, and then suddenly they just go their own way. How much of a risk is that on the econometric side that we're going to be fooled by randomness? We're going to see a correlation, and it works until it stops working.
No, I agree with you totally. I understand why people do this stuff, but I'm a bit of a skeptic about it myself. I think just what you said, there's a standard phrase which you were sort of paralleling, saying correlation is not causation.
Right.
And I think that's true, but people are so keen to make money for legitimate reasons that that's the easiest thing to do, and sometimes it works.
All right, I have to ask you, before I get to some of my favorite questions, I have to ask you about Spinoza's theory of emotions, which you mention in Models Behaving Badly. Moral concepts of good and evil, virtue and perspective, have a basis in human psychology, which naturally leads to the question, what does this have to do with trading models?
Well, Spinoza was like 300 years ahead of his time. I tried to read the Ethics once when I was writing my book because I was trying to find an example of something that I thought was a theory rather than a model.
Okay.
And what Spinoza did in the Ethics, although it was only published posthumously, was try to figure out, actually very, a lot like behavioral economists, but 300 years earlier, trying to figure out what drives people to behave the way they do. And his argument was that if he can understand the passions or the emotions, as he calls them, then he'll be able to understand why people are unhappy and then be able to figure out how they should live their lives. And so what he starts out doing is analyzing all the emotions, or as he calls them, the passions that there are. And he calls them passions because they affect you as a passive person rather than an active person. They sweep over you rather than you deciding you would want to behave that way. And it's actually, so A, it's very interesting, and B, it's really closely related to derivatives. It's sort of astonishing because what he does is he says at the bottom of the chain, there are only three things, which is pleasure, pain, and desire.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody knows what pleasure, pain, and desire are, but he actually defines it in some philosophical way. And then he defines every other emotion, and there are hundreds of them, verbally in terms of how they're reduced to pleasure, pain, and desire. So for example, love is expectation of pleasure from some other person, and pain is hatred is the opposite, expectation of pain. That's a little bit corny, but then for example, he says
so envy.
Yeah, envy is the one I wanted. I couldn't think of it. So he says envy. I have to try to remember.
It's
this
the
now.
Pain of absence of pleasure.
Yeah, and envy is wow, it's suddenly slipping me. I remember cruelty better.
Oh, cruelty.
Cruelty is what you call the desire of somebody else to inflict pain on someone that you love.
Mm-hmm.
So cruelty eventually goes down to pleasure, pain, and desire. And I like to say it's like a convertible bond that has both equity exposure, credit exposure, and fixed income exposure. It goes down to all three of the derivatives. So he's really got it. I actually drew a chart, which is
it's
on my website.
It's a giant Venn diagram, pleasure, yes. Pain, and desire.
Anything you point at eventually goes down through some chain to these three things at the bottom.
I wonder if there's a graphic of that somewhere.
I've got a graphic of it.
You do?
Yeah, it's on my website. And I was once going to make a poster out of it because it's really – in fact, I once submitted it. Somebody at the Serpentine Gallery in London had a map competition that somebody connected me to, and I submitted that as a map, and it's in a book somewhere.
Oh, really?
Maps of all kinds of things.
That's fascinating. So now let's move over to some of my favorite questions. These are the standard questions we ask everybody. So we went over how you got into the finance. Well, actually, we really didn't get that question. So you started as a physicist. How do you go from Boulder, Colorado, studying particle physics to I'm going to do quantitative work on Wall Street? How did that transition actually occur?
Kind of not planned. I got a PhD in 1973 from Columbia. And then, as I said, jobs were hard to find. And I had a postdoc at University of Pennsylvania. And then I had a job at Oxford in England. And then I had a job at Rockefeller University in New York. And my wife was in biology. And we were moving all over the world out of sync with each other, actually.
Right.
And then when we were in England together, we had a kid. And then we both had jobs in New York. And then it was very hard to get permanent jobs. I got a job in Boulder. She couldn't get a job there. I lived there for a while. And eventually I sort of threw in the towel. It was getting too complicated. And then this was 1980, where people went then was there was the oil crisis and telecom was building up. And you either people who were physicists either went to work for Exxon or Mobil, or they went to Bell Labs.
Place.
And I took a job at Bell Labs.
Later became Lucent. You were there for a good couple of years.
Yeah, I was there for 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
And so then I stopped doing physics and I worked in a business analysis center that sort of was applying physics techniques or mostly programming to AT&T business problems.
That's funny because when I saw your background and that you were at Bell Labs at Lucent, I assumed you were doing some fine physics work as it applied to telecom.
No.
I never for a second said, oh, well, he must be working in the finance
department.
Yeah,
I was a sort of retread when I went there. And
how did that lead to Goldman Sachs?
Well, That was 1980 when I went there, and I started working on actually much more computer programming. I learned to be a good programmer at the time. Mm-hmm. And we were tackling sort of problems that AT&T had where you could use sort of computer modeling and financial modeling. I didn't like it very much. I learned a lot of useful stuff, but I always really hankered to go back to a more academic job, but that was too difficult. And then all the headhunters started knocking on the doors of people because interest rates were high and Salomon and Goldman and these places were hiring people. And it took me a few years to adjust the idea, but I decided I would take a leap out of the whole sphere and into the business world. It was sort of a shock for me. I never expected to ever do that.
And it worked out pretty well.
Yeah, I got very excited, as I say. When I went to Goldman in 85, it was like a shot in the arm for me.
And you were there through 2000 with a brief period at Salomon.
I was at Salomon for 1 year or a little bit more, and then in mortgages, and then I went back to Goldman. I started in fixed income. I went to Salomon in mortgages, and then I came back, and I was in equity derivatives for like 10 years, which was really my favorite area.
And it sounds like you thrived and did really well there. So let's talk about mentors. Who were some of your early mentors?
Oh, in physics or in, well...
Both.
Yeah. Oh, in physics, there were a couple of professors in South Africa that I worked for. There was a guy called Professor Whiteman who sort of tutored me. He's long dead, probably.
Mm-hmm. And how about in the finance side?
In finance, I would say Fisher Black the most, in that I got there and there was still not a lot of quants at Goldman. And I got involved immediately in working for the bond options trading desk, and they connected me with Fisher because he was the expert, and he really had a very big impact on me. So I would say I don't think he set out to mentor me. He was kind of a bit of a cold fish in a nice way.
Uh-huh.
But I really learned a lot from him, both about perseverance and about not taking models too seriously.
Huh. Quite interesting. What investors influence the way you think about modeling or investing?
That's a good question. Now, To be honest, I don't invest that much. I'm a ETF mutual fund guy, in the old days, EDF now.
Right.
For a long time when I worked at Goldman, and I recently worked at a fund of funds, I wasn't allowed to buy individual stocks.
Right.
So
you're an indexer. Basically.
I'm an indexer pretty much. And
yeah,
I don't
by the
really
way, that is not
much.
Uncommon yeah. amongst academics who say, I don't have the interest, the time, the effort. I don't want to babysit a bunch of stocks on the possibility of outperforming. Let me just go.
Yeah, I'm kind of like that. I like it intellectually, but I don't, and I like following the markets, but, I have at times bought options years ago when I was allowed to, but I don't really do that anymore.
Hmm. Let's talk about books.
I always liked Peter Lynch.
Interesting guy, right?
Yeah,
fascinating guy.
In the days
guy.
When I was fascinated by the stuff, yeah.
A quick digression. I always thought Peter Lynch and the idea that when you're out looking at things on your own and you discover stuff, I don't know if that still exists anymore.
Yeah, I kind of like that. A few times I used to do that. I remember noticing with my kids years ago that all of my kids' friends' mothers were wearing Reebok shoes before I'd ever heard of Reebok, when they were all doing aerobics, and they were all drinking Clearly Canadian at some point.
Mm-hmm.
These are all like 25 years ago.
Sure.
And I remember going into Lululemon a few years ago and being amazed by the good running gear they had, and seeing people drink Keurig Green Mountain. So I still like the idea that you spot something that you like. Or I was like that about Apple, actually, where you just love the product and you say, I'm going to go with it, without reading about EBIT or EBITDA or anything like that.
The question is, given how sophisticated technology and biotech and all sorts of things that require an expertise, everything you've described is either a consumer product.
Yeah.
In fact, they're all consumer products.
They're all consumer products.
So does the Peter Lynch approach, is it still valid given that so much of the market is not related to retail or consumer spending? It's like, stop and think about it. You're not doing biotech, you're not doing pharma, you're not doing almost all of these different software, hardware, networking, technology companies. I wonder if Peter Lynch is of an era, and maybe that era no longer exists.
Yeah, I'm inclined to agree with you. Yeah. I have friends who went into money management after they left Goldman, into their own money management firms. And occasionally one of them says to me, well, this has been a really hard time to be a money manager for the last 15 years. And then I think, well, kind of what are you getting paid for?
Right.
You know, but how do you, it's hard to do better than other people. And, you know, he sort of imagines maybe that the world should keep, prices should keep going up and he should get paid 2 and 20 for that.
You well, know? That's, you know, if you're just buying a trend, you might as well just do the ETF.
Yeah, yeah.
My Peter Lynch experience is I moved out of the city to the suburbs.
Yeah.
It's like 15 years ago, maybe even a little, it was before 9/11. So it was just before 2001. And I discovered this new company that nobody had ever heard of called Home Depot. And I'm like, wow, this place is amazing. They have everything. And
the when you were furnishing your house.
We were fixing up the house. Yeah. First thing I do is like, I have to buy some of this company. And I punch it up in a on the Bloomberg. And it's just done nothing but go up for like 15 years. I'm like the last person on the planet who discovered Home Depot. So that was my like, oh, I guess I'm a little late to the Peter Lynch party with Home Depot. I know you like books and I know you like philosophers, so I have to ask, what are some of your favorite books?
Okay.
Fiction, nonfiction, finance related, it doesn't matter.
Fiction, I like sort of I like good romantic books, so I like Anna Karenina and I like Madame Bovary.
Okay.
Those are two of my favorite. And Lolita, I have to say. So all have a similar theme. People obsessively in love. That's always a good story. Nonfiction. Yeah, I like history, although I have a hard time suddenly thinking of things, but I sort of like Goethe. I read mostly a lot of modern fiction.
Mm-hmm.
But nonfiction, I like some philosophy. I like Schopenhauer. I like Schopenhauer the most because he's kind of cynical in a very readable sort of way.
You've referenced him several times.
Yeah.
So what's your favorite work of Schopenhauer?
There's a collection that I have called Essays and Aphorisms. It's a thin penguin book with a lot of essays about everything from getting old to wisdom to how you should not read until you've exhausted thinking.
Huh.
And very good and very, very beautifully written. A little bit like Freud, like he could get a Nobel Prize just for his writing style.
Really? That's fascinating.
There's a thin penguin. I've got it for years, but it's called Essays and Aphorisms.
I'll look it up.
And really funny.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I mean in a slightly bitter sort of way, but very sharp.
So you strike me as someone who would read Feynman, who's brilliant and acerbic and funny all at the same time.
Yes, I studied the Feynman lectures, and I actually shook his hand once in a men's room at a keynote conference in Aachen. And not shook his hand, I spoke to him in 1974. But he was a phenomenal guy. I heard him speak several times.
The essays are supposed to be phenomenal. Yeah. The lectures are supposed to be phenomenal. I got a birthday gift.
Of the three red books?
No, I got someone gave – actually, it was a gift to somebody else that they re-gifted to me. It was all the CDs of the
Feynman lectures,
and they were all, none of them worked. It was I don't know what the heck to do. I have like 12 CDs. They're essentially paperweights, but it's like the whole box set, and I don't know what
it was. DVD or it was
CD
because it was done in the 60s.
And it's I'm sure I could pick up another set somewhere, but it's sitting somewhere in my basement in a box. The Feynman lectures, all CDs. They're all completely.
Don't read much physics anymore. I have to admit, I've sort of. I like to keep up in a popular way, but I don't read anything.
There's a handful of astrophysics blogs I still track. Phil Plait is a guy whose Twitter handle is Bad Astronomer.
I haven't seen that.
And he writes some really interesting stuff. He can bring some really complex things to an understandable. At this point, I'm a layperson, not a. You know, not able to keep up with any of the higher math, but the ongoing advancements in physics are just phenomenal. Most recently, the gravitational waves, and it's just of all the sciences that are eventually going to crack the secrets to the universe, it looks like physics is way out ahead of everybody else.
Yeah, it's astonishing. If you start out in physics, you kind of get spoiled for everything else.
That's a good way to, and it's nice to sit back and say, well, I'm glad I don't have double labs anymore, but it's interesting to watch this. And it almost seems that the pace of new knowledge is accelerating. Look, we just landed on that comet last year. These things were hard to even imagine outside of science fiction a decade ago. And it's really, to me, that stuff is is utterly fascinating.
Yeah, I almost have a slightly religious feeling about it, although I'm not really religious, but you think about this gravitational wave thing and you say, okay, it took 100 years for 1,000 people to verify the prediction of one guy 100 years ago.
Of Einstein, know? Right.
Yeah, and the fact that somebody could figure out the way the universe works just by pure thought, it's sort of an intuition, which he then elaborates into a model. It's just sort of, yeah, it's enough to make you a believer almost.
There's a fascinating book, as long as we're talking about this. So and now I'm drawing a blank on the name. There's a very famous physicist who asked about why we've never come across life elsewhere. Where is Fermi's paradox?
Oh, okay.
Where is everybody? So if you have you have 200 billion stars in a galaxy, there are billions and billions of galaxies. How is it possible that we've never come across any other intelligent life anywhere else? And some interesting biologists and physicists put together what they call the rare Earth thesis, which is essentially life is common on the planet. But in the universe, but intelligent life is relatively rare because the universe turns out to be a very hostile place. So that gravitational wave that hit us was relatively modest, but there are magnetars and there are all sorts of pulsars. And if you're even like a few hundred light years away, the gamma waves and the radiations that wash over essentially sterilize the planet of all life. It eventually comes back, but intelligent life needs a lot of stability for a long time. I find that sort of stuff endlessly fascinating.
Yeah, I did too. And
the parallels to finance are very much there if you sit back and think about it a little bit.
Yeah, that's really, I think I've seen a version of this that's really interesting. And I think I've only read about descriptively, but where they say you might get intelligent life, but sooner or later they destroy themselves and they're unable to communicate with the rest of the universe by reverting back to a fairly primitive state.
That either universe, so first of all, you have to be in the exact right sweet spot, distance from the sun. You have to hope a meteor doesn't come along or any of the early solar system formations that hits you. There's another thesis that says, so the Earth has this giant oversized moon relative to all the other planets. And but for that, you may not have had tides, which really led to accelerating a lot of just taking protein strings and leading to minerals and taking tides all the way inland and then having the tides leave. You get that with an oversized moon without that. So, you know, once you study physics, you can never really let it go. It's always there. I find that stuff. I don't know how we had this, where this digression came from, other than Schopenhauer's essays and aphorisms, I guess, and Feynman stuff, which is fascinating. So since you joined the industry, boy, that was like I don't know where that digression came from.
That's okay. That was.
But it's in the back of my head, and it's.
I never heard that about the moon making. Making life possible somehow.
Well, it's not so much that it made it possible, but you end up with these really large tidal. Now, keep in mind, the moon is slowly moving away from the Earth. And a few millennia ago, a few billion years ago, it was much closer, which, by the way, raises a whole nother question. How did this moon end up around this planet? Was it captured? Were there two moons? One of which got absorbed into the other. I mean, there's all sorts of theses as to how you end up with a really big moon relative to a mid-sized planet. When we look at Jupiter or Saturn, they have, 100? There's dozens and dozens of moons, all of which
much
are
smaller,
teeny tiny compared
that,
So it's. I'll dig up the name of that book I read a while ago. I think it's called Rare Earth, but if you like the occasional physics nonfiction, you might find
this.
I will
look for that.
And it is a little, not religious or spiritual, but anything that changes your perspective of our place in the universe is really kind of fascinating and spiritual and curious. Although there are people who insist Fermi's right and will eventually
find
people. Yeah. But so far, and then there's another thesis that says, why are you looking for them? If they can communicate with you, they could come here and basically, oh, a nice planet to...
Well, there's a third one that says, don't let anybody see you, because look what happened to people in the Amazon or to the Bushmen.
Exactly. That
so
we
just keep quiet.
We are the American Indians, and anybody who's coming, superior technology, superior ability to do whatever they want, and let's hope that doesn't happen anytime soon. But we digress. So let's go back to quantitative finance. So since you started in that industry, what do you think are the biggest changes that have affected finance?
I think electronic trading and electronic markets and the effect that's had filtering down on everything. So kind of computers, in a sense, no more open outcry, everything matched by computer. And that certainly affected the careers of people.
Did that enable a lot of what we see on the quantitative side to progress? Without that, you're kind of at an impasse, aren't you?
Yeah, they kind of go in lockstep. You know, you can now get good price data, good volatility data. I guess the bond market isn't really electronic yet, but heading in that direction. And currencies are still over the counter. But I think that's the biggest trend, that people can now trade by algorithms and trade by computer. And those skills are more and more in demand.
So when you look at models, so you can create models for equities and derivatives, and you can create models for fixed income. Can we not create models for currencies because of the way they're traded?
You can still make models, but they're kind of harder to implement because I don't know how it is now, I'm a little out of date, but you had to call somebody and you can't really do statistical arbitrage easily, where you have an algorithm that just sends out orders and buys when it needs to and sells when it needs to, because you still have to call somebody on the telephone.
That's amazing.
And you had to do that in equities too, sort of 25 years ago, whereas now nobody makes calls.
I wonder why currencies aren't as automated or as electronically driven as some of these other asset classes.
Yeah, because actually they should be, in the sense that they're, it's hard to do with bonds, because bonds are very idiosyncratic and there aren't one stock.
There's millions of different bonds. And
yeah, but currencies are, and I think it'll go that way. I think partly because, in a cynical sort of way, there's a lot of money to be made by, I think, probably the people who trade currencies. My guess would be that they're reluctant to go electronic, because there's a lot of, you look at what Chase charging you 3% for every time you use your credit card in a foreign country. There's very big margins over there.
So it hasn't gone electronic because there's a big incentive for
it not to. I think there's incentive to not to. Huh. Did you see somebody got into trouble, some bank, a few months ago for giving clients the worst price, the worst currency price of the day?
Consistently.
Yeah, consistently giving them the low if they were selling and the high if they were buying.
That's amazing. Why are we not surprised by that?
Yeah.
We've talked about what's changed in the past. What are the upcoming shifts that you see that's going to impact quants or impact the concept of quantitative modeling?
I'll try to think a little bit about this as you're talking. just extensions of what's happening. I think the vanishing of small investors, which has been happening. And maybe not so much in Japan, but it certainly happened here, and I think is now starting to happen in Japan.
What about China, which seems to be...
Yeah, I was going to say China.
Seems to be all mom-and-pop investors. When does that become more mature and institutionalized?
Yeah, I think that's doomed in the long run.
Oh, really?
I mean, I think mom-and-pop investors are doomed in the long run, and in China too. China's still manipulating their markets a lot, as far as I can tell.
So how does that play out?
I suppose badly at some point. China's markets will collapse and
worse than what we've this 40% correction we've seen.
I would guess, although I'm not really good at predicting the future about this stuff, but I think as China's going to have to democratize, now you see a lot of people are trying to get money out of the country, they're gonna have to put in capital controls. It'll be interesting to see what happens. Certainly in the program I teach, it's sort of astonishing. 80% of the students are basically from mainland China.
Really?
Yep.
That's a wild number, 80%.
And that's true in most of the sciences in this country.
Are they going back home, or is this a way to get out of the country?
A mix. Mm-hmm. But a lot of them, it's an expensive program. People pay, $60,000 or $80,000 a year to study, plus living costs.
Right.
Chinese have money. They get they can get money out of the country until now.
To pay for tuition, or is this just a way to?
No, this is for tuition, and so yeah, there are millions of. It's good. There are millions of Chinese students in this country. Some stay, some go back. But really, the graduate schools in the sciences, and certainly in the financial engineering programs, but I think in physics in general, all run on foreign students and Chinese.
Why
students.
Is that? That's fascinating.
It's a good. And when I worked at Goldman, I ran this quant group. You know, the majority were foreign, not necessarily Chinese, but the majority were. I don't know.
What I see in a lot of math is so it's Chinese, it's Korean, it's Indian.
Yeah. Used to be Jews, sort of 50 years ago.
And so, yeah. What is it? Each subsequent generation of immigrants takes the hardest working area until the next generation. Yeah, how does that work?
Yeah, I think that's what kind of happens. They immigrants come in and do the stuff that's hard, not so much hard in a difficult sense, but hard in that very concrete,
right?
In that you know what success is and you know what being good at it means. And then their kids want to be businessmen.
Right. They don't want to work that hard.
Yeah.
So then that opens up. So first it was the Jews, and then it's Asians, and then it's, in other words, each subsequent generation of immigrants.
Yeah, that's what seems
you know,
to
a
happen.
Friend of mine is fond of pointing out that when you mentioned a lot of the Jews had come over in a wave of immigration studying the sciences, at one point in time, the predecessor to the NBA, which back then was heavily represented with Jewish basketball players.
Oh, really?
And I was astonished when I first heard it. But neither did I. The first time I heard that, I'm like, what? Come on, you're pulling my leg. Huh. But it's the same thesis of a wave of immigrants comes. They're willing to do stuff that everybody who's here and somewhat wealthy and a little spoiled perhaps don't want to do.
Yeah.
And then after they go through that and achieve some degree of success, their kids don't want to do that, and it creates yet another opening. And then the next wave of immigrants come. That was I wonder how far this continues. Who's going to follow the Chinese after that? But 80% of your students as Chinese.
Yeah,
that's an amazing.
In this master's program of like 100 students, I would say, I'm guessing a little bit, I would say 40% come straight from mainland China.
Mm-hmm.
Another 40% come from America or Europe, but they're Chinese citizens and went there undergrad.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, this is sort of a little funny, but my son, who lives in Hong Kong, he teaches history at Hong Kong University of Science and Technology. And when I've been there, I've sat in on his class, and his classroom looks more cosmopolitan than mine.
Really?
Yeah.
I wonder what that's about. That's quite fascinating.
You know, he's got some fair amount of
expats and things like that.
Expats and people or Australians who come there, whereas our classes are pretty much nothing wrong with it, but that just shows you where it's going.
So your students who graduate the master's degree in financial engineering, where do they end up working after that?
Some in China, some in money management, some in risk management, a few in trading, some in non-purely financial firms. Now there's a big trend towards machine learning and big data.
What percentage of your students stay in the United States and work in that field?
I would guess 50 or 60, but I'm actually on shaky ground now. I don't know for the last
But a
year.
Ballpark about half not wouldn't surprise you.
Yeah.
Huh. That's quite fascinating. So speaking of students, what sort of advice would you give to a millennial or someone who's just graduating from school and is interested in a career in modeling and quantitative finance?
Okay. Somewhat cynical stuff. I don't know. I would say, first of all, I started out thinking I was going to have one career. And
you're
the same from what you were telling
me.
And then you discover that you're going to change and life is
repeatedly
different nowadays. Yeah, me too. So I've kind of had three in a sense. I started in physics. Then I went to Bell Labs for a while. And then I ended up in finance. So I would say expect to have more than one career. Don't expect you're going to do one thing for the same time. It's actually quite invigorating to change.
Sure. It's a whole different set of muscles and
really
a different
is.
Set of skills you have to
and
learn.
After 20 years, it's kind of nice to have a difference. I would say get good at programming. At least that's my experience in almost anything. If you can do your own, I like to tell people to be willing to get your hands dirty and do your own dirty work. Don't just be a manager, maybe one day. But that's the thing I was going to say earlier. It somehow seems to me a lot of, maybe not now after the internet craze, but in the 90s, most Americans, and when I worked at Bell Labs, most Americans wanted to be managers and most foreigners wanted to work with their hands or their heads, so to speak.
Right.
And now it's changed a little bit. I'm getting off topic. It's changed a little bit because Americans are suddenly discovering that you can get rich by being a good programmer like Mark Zuckerberg or somebody like that. And so it's changed a little bit. But for a long time, it seemed to me Americans wanted to be managers, so why go do financial engineering, whereas foreigners sort of had no choice.
I wonder how much of that was a post-World War II phenomena. Because if you think about the era that followed the Second World War, you had a huge rise of corporations and what we almost derisively describe as middle management today was a path to a reasonably safe, certain, comfortable job. But that's all gone away a long time ago. I wonder how much of that is demographics and how that's changed.
Yeah, that's interesting. Probably a large part. I was trying to think. So I was saying be willing to do your own dirty work, get your hands dirty.
And learn to program yourself.
Learn to program. Don't ignore, I don't know, I was going to say. One thing I kind of learned is when I left particle physics, I was sort of a little bit disgusted with myself that I thought I was going to be a physicist and I wasn't going to be one. And there were jobs in applied physics as opposed to pure research, like in energy or heat, you know, heat stuff. And I didn't want to do that. I thought if I'm going to get out of physics, I'm going to go sort of all the way. And it worked for me. But at the same time, I realized over the years that almost everything is interesting and that maybe I was wrong. I could have gotten just as interested in doing something else. So I think the more
applied as opposed to theoretical physics.
Yeah, and maybe it might have still been interesting. But I sort of scorned it at the time in a snobbish sort of way. And my experience over the years with lots of things is that when you get involved in them hardcore and deeply, you find all sorts of interesting things that you didn't expect. And so I think that's the advice I would give people is plunge in, and if you have to do something different, and when you get deep inside, you find a whole world opening up.
And then our final question, what is it that you know about modeling, about investing, about quantitative finance today you wish you knew 30 years ago when you were first stepping into the field?
Don't get out when things look bad.
Don't get out.
When things look bad, because in the long run, don't sell at the bottom.
So in other words, mean regression, that reversion to the mean is eventually...
I used to be one of these people that when everything was about to collapse, I thought, oh my God, like now I'd better sell before it goes to zero.
And it never goes to zero.
But it doesn't go to... so far, it doesn't go to zero. So I would say take a long-term view and ignore the fluctuations. But it's hard to do.
Professor Derman, I have to thank you for being so generous with your time. This has really been a fascinating conversation. I could sit here for hours longer, but I know you have places to go and things to do. To review, if people want to find your work, My Life is a Quant is on Amazon. Models Behaving Badly can be found just about anywhere. EmmanuelDerman.com, at Emmanuel Derman on Twitter. And your homepage is on at Columbia?
I don't actually have one at Columbia. I just have emmanuelderman.com. And I once wrote a book of columns and short stories, which you can get on Amazon as an ebook that I put there myself.
And what's the name of that book?
It's called Bad Behavior.
Bad Behavior. Yes. I'm going to write that down.
It's
That's
not
great.
A big bestseller by any means. But I once wrote a bunch of columns for a German newspaper. There was an editor there. He actually died shortly after, so the Frankfurter Allgemeine Zeitung, who liked Models Behaving Badly. And for about a year, I wrote a column for them every 2 weeks.
Uh-huh.
And I took most of it. They put it into German, but I had it in English, and I put most of it into this little book.
I'll put a link up to this when this goes up. Thank you so much for your time. For those of you who enjoy this conversation, look up or down an inch on iTunes, and you could see all of our prior conversations. I would be remiss if I did not thank my research director, Michael Batnick, who helped do the deep dive into Professor Derman's background. Special thanks to Taylor Riggs for handling all the booking and Charlie Vollmer for being our producer. You're listening to Masters in Business on Bloomberg Radio.